Part 2. Chapter 5. Raylan Kaur. Raylan Kaur War College, early spring. Rundal. Rundal looked up at the foreboding fortress, and a chill went up his spine. He suppressed the feeling of dread the edifice inspired, partially because he knew the place had been designed to inspire that feeling, and partially because he felt he deserved whatever horrors lay within. The guilt over Astasia's death had been a burden he could not escape. The 6-day journey from Inarion upriver and across country to the War College had given him far too much time to dwell on his failure, and he arrived at the War College with a dark and heavy heart. He was no stranger to death. No one who had walked out of Beauval Vale would be. He had seen dozens of the people he knew slaughtered by the Gavanni. Astasia's death was different. Even though he had known her only a few weeks, he had become very attached to her, his feelings far in excess of reason, considering the nature of their relationship. But her death hurt more, somehow, than most he'd lost at Beauval. He was emotionally numb over the event. He knew people died in war, and he'd seen it. He'd participated, even. But to have someone that young, someone he knew and liked, suddenly just be not there, and have another human, and someone else he'd known, be the cause, that had been a grim novelty, one he wasn't certain of how to recover from. He'd brooded about the tragedy for the entire journey, on barge and from the back of a rented horse. He'd barely spoken on the way to Raylan Kaur. He knew, intellectually, that it wasn't his fault. The sinister Brotherhood of the Rat had seen her as an obstacle, so they had removed her. This was Raylan Pratt's fault, or Caffin of Gaia, as he styled himself. He cursed the name every time it sprang to mind. Even though it wasn't his hand who'd pushed her, it was the young Shadow Mage's ambition that had motivated the hand that had. Intellectually, he knew he was not at fault for her tragic, untimely death. Emotionally, that was a different story. He'd been given power beyond his years, yet he hadn't the wisdom or insight to see the Brotherhood of the Rat's plot for what it was, and Astasia had paid the price. He had barely eaten, and his sleep was restless and fitful. He felt numb all the time, and was growing more resentful of his fellow apprentice, Tyndall, every day. Tyndall's accusations afterward hadn't helped. Rundal was more than willing to blame himself for the tragedy at Inarion Academy, but then to see how the haystack-headed moron dealt with it made him sick. The young idiot had gotten blind drunk the day after Astasia's death, and the next day he barely mentioned it. He had plunged into his studies with an eagerness and determination that Rundal would have welcomed to see just days before. After Astasia's death, such devotion to mere academics just seemed disrespectful. There was a plot afoot, and reading parchment when he should be seeking vengeance just seemed petty. He felt he owed her that, after he'd been that unexpectedly intimate with her. The spell the three had done together to locate Tyndall's Witchstone had been the first time he had worked closely with another mage one-on-one, outside of training. It had been an intimacy he hadn't expected, and the shock of suddenly losing that connection had stunned his psyche terribly. Rundal found he couldn't study at Inarion anymore. Every time he passed the spot where her body had fallen, outside of the North Tower, under his window, he shuddered. The endless feast of learning he had been so enthusiastic about devouring at Inarion had grown stale. He could barely look at a book or scroll without thinking about Astasia, and she had barely even acknowledged his presence. Rundal imposed on the headmaster to release him early from his courses, and after making the proper arrangements, he headed upriver a week early. He didn't speed, didn't offer to assist the barge with a water elemental. He just sat curled up next to a bag of potatoes and a barrel of tar, and immersed himself in gloom. By the time he'd arrived at Raylan Kaur, he was inconsolable. Whatever hell awaited him there, he welcomed. The fortress looked like the kind of place fit for tortured souls. Raylan Kaur once had been the greatest fortress in the Western world. A relic of the Majocracy, it was the last largest permanent imperial presence before the frontier their Narasi conquerors had expanded. Raylan Kaur wasn't a castle. It was a 9-story quadrangle of granite and limestone, put together by the best Imperial War Magi at the height of the later Magocracy. Magi with witchstones and a centuries-old tradition of magically augmented defensive architecture. Raylan Kor was as strong as a mountain. It was perched atop a low, flat hill that overlooked the original Castorli Riverlands, in the middle of a mage-made lake 100 yards across. It was surrounded by rough territory, swamps and brambles and dark forests, briar-filled meads and marshy wetlands. When the first Dukes of Castorl arrived to take possession of their new fief, they resided and ruled from Raylan Kor for 50 years, before relocating to their new castle at the capital city, Castabriel. Rondal could see why they relocated. Raylan Kor was miserable. Designed for defence, not comfort, the fortress was a work of efficiency and imperial thoroughness. 6,000 men could live in Raylan Kor, and had, at the height of its use as an imperial outpost. But they had done so living forward to a room in dark little cells, not much better than a dungeon, eating and sleeping in tightly controlled shifts. The fortress had less than a quarter of that number living there now, but it must have been a sight to see during the Magocracy, Rondal decided. When the Great Keep at Castabriel was built, Raylan Kor became an expensive, unnecessary fortress, guarding a frontier that had shifted hundreds of leagues west. Yet its might and impregnability were too great to ignore. The Dukes had made it the official residence of the warlord of Castorl for a century or so, the seat of the colonel of the ducal army. After the warlord's residence was transferred to the capital, it became the Castorli War College. Rondal remembered reading about it in Farrad's Histories of Castorl and Rhemir. The vision to create an institution specifically for the purposes of teaching skills of warfare was not new, but it was foreign to the Narasi horsemen, who dealt with such matters by squiring. The ancestors of the modern Castorli had usually ignored infantry in favour of cavalry, but after the conquest, it became clear that, especially for the western duchies, infantry was an important consideration. Conscripting large numbers of peasants to throw at each other was an adequate, if wasteful, strategy. That worked for dynastic wars and inter-domain disputes, but against an organized force, such troops, untrained and untutored, were mere walking corpses. But the Dukes of Castorl had seen the wisdom of more advanced training, even if it meant arming their nobles with military wisdom that could threaten their own possessions. Regardless of who was on the throne, the idea was the duchy needed soldiers who knew what they were doing to protect it. They created the War College for that purpose. That, and to conserve the mighty library of ancient works on warfare that Raylan Kor boasted. Now it was the multi-purpose home of hundreds of masters in the arts of destruction and death. The Dukes hired experts in every aspect of warfare, from siege engines to field fortifications to basic infantry training to war magic, and it was all taught at Raylan Kor. It was the main staging area for the army that had invaded Faris, and since then it had collected plenty of veterans eager to pass on the wisdom of their bloody trade between wars. He showed his credentials at the gate, and was quickly directed inside by a steely-eyed sentry. Others were arriving too, he saw, as he passed 3 or 4 worried-looking boys on the way into the imposing main fortress. The commandant, Marshal Lagaran, welcomed him stiffly in his office, his one good eye peering at him appraisingly, the other hid under a silken band. He moved like a man who was more scar tissue than muscle. He quickly wrote down Sir Rondal's name on a scroll.
"Someone kill your dog, soldier."
Rondal looked confused.
"I'm not..."
"As of this moment, you are," the old veteran said, grinning grimly. "From the moment your name was written on the parchment, you've become a neophyte of the sacred mysteries of Duin. That makes you a soldier, even if you've never marched a mile. And Rondal, sorry, you temporarily lost your title when you were inducted, but I've got special orders for you. Report to the War Magic Master Valwyn. You still have a few days before the beginning of training, but he wants to work with you some on your own. See what you're made of."
Rondal let the opportunity for a witty retort pass. He knew what he was made of. He wasn't fond of it at the moment. Indeed, he desperately wanted to become something else. Someone else.
"Where can I find Master?"
"Master Valwyn," the commandant supplied. "Third floor, south side, all the way to the back.
and whatever pains you at the moment, soldier, realize that the mysteries send all that away from your soul. In 7 weeks you won't even remember what it was that disturbs you now. Rondol was surprisingly open to that possibility. If there was a way to destroy the boy he was, and put something better in its place, he had to try. Magic or mystery, warfare or scholarship, he desperately wanted to drown the pain of Inarion. It took Rondol almost an hour to wind his way through the narrow corridors and staircases that led him back to the office of the War Magic Master. The man who worked within was older than the Commandant, though less scarred, and had the confident bearing of one who is a master of his craft. He was known widely by reputation. Rondol had sought out some insight on the man when he'd queried other Magi mind to mind. He had yet to hear anything but praise. Rondol introduced himself to the War Magic Master and learned that Master Minolin had, indeed, set forth very specific instructions for him regarding his inclusion in the mysteries. The idea seemed to amuse the War Magic Master, too. The man bade him to sit in the single, uncomfortable chair that was the signature of any military office, and Master Valwin produced a pipe and a pouch, offering it to the young recruit. Rondol declined. "You are to be initiated into the sacred mysteries of the Imperial Infantry," he revealed, as if Rondol had won a prize, "or the mysteries of Duin, as they are called now, though the destroyer had little to do with their crafting. We held them 3 times a year, spring, summer, and autumn, according to the rites, and I will not deny they are brutal. Many neophytes have died before completion, although if it's any solace, Duin is supposed to reserve a special place in the afterlife for those whose hearts were valiant enough to undertake the mysteries, but whose bodies or fortunes were, alas, not strong enough to meet the challenge." "Is this really necessary for war magic training?" Rondol asked, confused. "Initiates come out far stronger candidates for more war magic training," agreed Valwin, stroking his beard. "Not to mention far more effective on the battlefield, since they understand the perspective of the grunt, and not just the spark. But more importantly, they make you what you need to be, a soldier, before you add in magic. It makes a difference," he insisted. "If we hadn't done that with the Frisian conscripts, we would have lost to Oriel Pratt, no matter how many troops we threw at him." Rondol quickly tried to change the subject from Oriel Pratt. That was a name he did not want to hear. "I'm already schooled in some war magic, Master," Rondol pointed out. Valwin chuckled. "You just think you are, son. And I hope you do know some. It is not forbidden to use war magic in the mysteries. Indeed, there are dozens of bright young war magi gathering for their initiation. But Master Minolin did not want you to have undue advantage." "What?" Rondol asked, confused. "What do you mean, Master?" "He was very specific about this. You are to secure your witch stone in my office for the duration of the mysteries, and rely on whatever native skills and abilities you might have, unaugmented by Irionite. Yes, I'm aware of the recent difficulties," he said understandingly, when Rondor's face went pale. "I realize what I'm asking of you. Master Minolin suggested you contact him directly if you had any questions." That sounded like his master.
I can see the wisdom in that," he conceded. "But there is the matter of security, of which you are naturally concerned. I assure you, it will be concealed and spellbound. No one will know where it is but you and me, and I'm in line for my own stone soon enough," he said. "I won't so much as touch it, I swear by Duin, Luin, and Huin." Of course, Rondol was concerned. He was loath to let his stone leave his possession, but a quick conversation with Master Minolin, mind to mind, convinced him of the necessity. When his master insisted, he had little choice. Master Valwin provided a small stone box in which he could secure it, one alarmingly similar to the one in which Tyndall's witch stone had been hidden. The moment the insulating lid was shut, he felt his contact with the precious green amber fade. "Now we both spellbind it," Valwin instructed. "That way it can't be opened until we both release it." When they were done, Rondol felt naked. It was tortuous, yet it suited his mood. He wanted to feel something, anything, but relentless remorse and guilt. He'd gotten his wish. Suddenly, he just felt weak. "Just relax, son," Valwyn soothed him as he tucked the box in a chest under a shelf of books and scrolls. "It won't go anywhere. You need to learn war magic the hard way. Once you pick it up again," he promised, "you'll be a different person entirely."
"I find myself anticipating the prospect, Master," Rondell said formally.
"Good," nodded the War Mage. "I'll assign you quarters for the next few days. You'll have the run of the commissary, practice yard, and library until the mysteries begin."
Is it prohibited for me to ask what to expect, Master?"
"You'd be an idiot not to. There are 3 days of ritual purification and cleansing and examination by the War Brothers of Duin, as well as a few other war gods, in the shrine encampment in the main field. Once you are deemed a sound neophyte, then you'll be assigned to a troop and squad, and for the next 6 weeks after that, you'll find out what hell looks like. Army life." The introduction to the routine at elementary training camp was an initiation as brutal as promised. He had passed the purification rituals, a series of fasts and vigils, interrogations, physical examinations and spiritual explorations, anointings and cleansings, until his head spun. By the third day, Rondell barely remembered his own name, so confused was he by the whirlwind of procedure. On the third day, he and every other neophyte gathered, and there were slightly over 300, were given a rich honey cake, the kind baked for funerals, and a full glass of robust, blood-like red wine. The wine was drugged, and he and his nameless companions felt a sense of intoxication and anticipation as they were driven to dance by bonfire light to the vocal encouragement of the War Brothers. Then he collapsed and slept, and when he awoke the next morning, cold and wet with the early spring dew, his neophyte shift providing no protection, he struggled awake through the lingering fog of the drug. When he was noticed, a tall War Brother with a horned headdress came by and examined his eyes.
"Duin has accepted you," he confirmed with a smile. "Get up, go to the far end of the field, and there you will find a War Brother with a large cauldron. Take no more than a swallow of the brew and reach into the bag and draw forth your token. You will understand from there," the monk assured him.
Rondell stumbled groggily to comply, stepping around sleeping young men as far as the eye could see. There were 7 or 8 War Brothers surveying the field, and apparently the quickness with which one recovered was propitious in their rites, somehow. Rondell took a sip of the sour-tasting, lukewarm brew and almost gagged, but he kept it down.
"Good lad," the scar-faced War Brother grinned, displaying broken teeth. "Just reach in here and see where you're bunking. Now,"
he made a point of shuffling around the tokens within the sack, praying absently to Ifnia to guide his hand. He pulled out a black stone with a stylized picture of a mammal on it.
"Ah, the Rekiel," nodded the War Brother approvingly. "Night fighters they are, nocturnal, vicious too when cornered, and clever."
Rondell had never seen one. They were not native to Isminden's home, nor to Sevendor. But he had to admit the toothy-looking predator carved into the token had some style.
"Now find your way to your squad. That's a stone, not a slate, tile, or chip, so you're in second company on the right. You'll see your encampment soon enough. It has a pole with that device on it. Your duty officer and the War Brother assigned to your company will be there shortly to provide you further instruction."
"Then what?" Rondell asked dumbly.
"Use the time until then to get to know your squad mates. You're going to have to start depending on them, and if you're smart, you'll figure out which ones are dependable. And that's going to be important once you get to the right foot. Good luck, and may Duin's blessing go with you, soldier."
His camp, like the others, was in a lobe of meadow, one of many off the main training field. It was a relatively dry patch of grass that was nearly surrounded by marshlands. The camps on the northern side all faced stony patches and briar fields. Only the vast green practice field between the sides seemed to offer any respite from the nasty terrain around the fortress. Even with the directions, it still seemed to take forever for Rondell to find the right little alcove in the brush,
but eventually he saw a tall pole of pine, with a stylized Raquel symbol, matching his stone, affixed to the top. There were already a few boys there, and more were showing up every moment. Randall set about learning who his squadmates were while they waited, as the war brother had advised him. They all seemed just as exhausted and emotionally challenged as Randall after the previous night's purification ceremony. Some looked ill. There was the usual cautious exchange of names, titles, and origins. They quickly lost all respect for such things. No one cared if he was a war mage. No one cared if he was a knight. No one seemed to care about anything but clearing their drug-fogged brains and sour stomachs. But Randall learned a fair amount about his new comrades while he waited. There were 10 of them in the squad. Closest to his own rank, there were 3 young squires, whose masters had felt they would benefit from some intensive training. Geoffard, Handel, and Verd, the squires, seemed overly eager, like young boys camping out overnight for the first time. They did not seem to appreciate the gravity of the mysteries, though they were clearly strong, healthy, and used to practicing with arms. 2 of the common men, Rax and Dolwyn, were both sons of professional men-at-arms, whose fathers had not been able to secure a squirehood for them. This was a far faster means to a career in arms than patiently holding a spear for years. A Raylan Corps certificate would earn them a place as a petty officer at any mercenary outfit in the duchies. It was well worth the bounty their sires had paid. Both boys seemed to take the mysteries fairly seriously. The other 2 commoners seemed worthy enough. Orphil was the bastard son of someone of high rank, who wanted to do right by the boy. The other, Walvin, was a sly-looking imperial from Rhaemir, who kept his motivations and plans to himself. He had a keen eye for everything around him, which Randall appreciated, but he also had a bit of aloofness that made him seem a bit intimidating. There were also, to Rondal's surprise, 2 other prospective war magi. One, Gurrendor, was a tall lad with a cockeyed smile, who had failed out of Alar Academy, but had passed his examinations anyway. He sought a viable career as a war mage, and wanted to hear all about Rondal's experience. The other, Yeetin, was even more bookish than Randall. He was the smallest lad in the squad, and seemingly the weakest. His frail arms and legs seemed like brittle sticks, and his shoulders hunched over in an almost debilitating way. His lifeless shock of brown hair refused to leave his eyes, and his voice grated in everyone's ears like rusty anchor chains from the moment he opened his mouth. Randall could almost hear the sour thoughts in his squadmates' heads as Yeetin introduced himself. Just what was he doing here at the Mysteries? He did not look up to being an infantryman. In fact, he seemed completely unsuited to any profession where strength might play a role. Even more so than Gareth, back in Sevendor. Yeetin was a mystery at the Mysteries, one everyone speculated upon when he was not around. As the sun climbed the sky, their duty officer arrived with a wheelbarrow full of gear. Ancient Feslin. He was a large fellow, a veteran of several campaigns and, as all of their instructors were, an initiate of the advanced 3rd degree of the Mysteries.
"Good morning, gentlemen," he greeted them.
Ron could not tell from his tone if he was being genuine or mocking, but Feslin seemed enthusiastic about the Mysteries.
"In this kettle is enough grits and bacon to get you started, but we can have that after the rest of the gear is unloaded. Get moving!" he barked.
Some of the boys were reluctant, and the 3 squires seemed to think such work was beneath them. Ancient Feslin soon corrected that notion in a small but intense private conference. After that, they seemed quite willing to pitch in. The supplies were scant, Randall could see as they were unloaded. They found 1 piece of sailcloth, 10 blankets, a kettle, a clay urn of water, a knife, 10 bowls, 10 spoons, and a hamper of food. Randall started dressing as soon as he could. The tunics they wore for that day's opening rite were long, undyed hempen affairs over their trousers and campishoed boots. Compared to Randall's riding boots, purchased on a whim in Castabriel, the heavy infantry boots seemed to be made of lead. They each got 1 stick of firewood. That was it. "Where's the flint?" asked Geoffard, annoyed at the lack. "How are we supposed to lay a fire without flint?"
"That's your problem, soldier," Ancient Feslin said as he came by to check on them. "The first of many. That hamper that seems so full is the only food you will be issued for this week. Use it wisely. That water jar is the only one you will be issued, as are all of the other pieces of equipment. That hardly seems fair, Joffard complained.
Did someone tell you that our sacred Lord Duin valued fairness? The ancient chuckled. Because they lied to you. War is not about fairness. It's about survival under adversity. I'm certain you'll think of something. Or you're going to have a very cold night. And that goes for the rest of you, he called out to the squad as they struggled into their new fatigues. This is not a fair contest. It is not a contest at all. This is not some pretty tournament. It is a sacred mystery, with no lesser end than turning you into a real soldier, or kill you trying. If you are not careful, it will kill you. In fact, it can kill you in 100 different ways if you are not cautious and careful. And even then, it can still kill you.
Surely one of you churls can manage a fire?
Verd called out, a bit contemptuously, as he scowled at the empty fire pit.
I would be more cautious of treating your squadmates like that, Verd, Feslin admonished, because if they can, they have very little reason to share that skill with a squadmate who calls them such things. There are no churls here, no commoners, and no nobles. There are only your fellow neophytes, your sacred squadmates. Piss them off and the mysteries can get pretty rough. Work together, and you might just survive.
Well, how are we supposed to start a fire? Demanded Verd, who didn't seem particularly bright.
Any way you like, the ancient said unhelpfully. If you want additional fuel, you may scavenge the swamps around you at your leisure. But I wouldn't recommend leaving your camp unguarded. Keep in mind that all of the other squads are likewise provisioned, and if they run short, well, it isn't unheard of for raiding to occur.
Raiding? Asked Yeetin, his eyes wide.
His voice came out like a braying donkey.
It can get vicious, admitted the veteran soldier as he surveyed the boys. Not usually the first few nights, but toward the end of the first week, when the hamper starts to run empty.
So we had better set a watch, suggested Walven.
A good watch, too. I don't aim to go hungry this week.
You will have a full week's worth of work ahead of you, whether you eat or not. But protecting your supplies is your responsibility. Tomorrow you'll be issued your squad banner. Your banner is the symbol of your troop. To let it fall into someone else's hands is highly dishonorable. It should be protected as if it were your sister's virtue.
You haven't met my sister, remarked Gurrendor.
Opening ceremonies in an hour, gentlemen. Feslin grinned, ignoring the quip. I would really encourage you not to be late. Duin dislikes the tardy.
Well, I still don't see how that's going to get a fire lit, snorted Verd.
You have magi with you, he reminded the boy, rolling his eyes. Try rubbing a few together and you might get sparks.
What did he mean by that? Demanded the boy, after the ancient left.
Watch, Rondel said with a sigh, as he bent to lay the fire properly. When he had tinder and kindling, gathered from twigs in the brush, he whispered a mnemonic and summoned a very little bit of power, and the fire ignited.
That was handy, said Handel, grinning.
That was easy, boasted Yeetin.
It is, Rondel admitted, if you know how.
The boys sat around the small fire and tried to make plans about how to contend with the sudden threat to their sustenance.
We should divide the food evenly now, suggested Gurrendor. Make each man responsible for his own portion, and see each man lose and prove a drain on his squadmates,
dismissed Rex. No, we eat as a squad. We fight as a squad.
Still, I see the benefit of hiding at least a portion of it, Handold proposed. Maybe in two separate caches. We can keep a third out at a time.
That seems awfully complicated,
grunted Verd, poking at the fire with a stick.
It's a sensible precaution, argued Handel.
So is setting a watch. Who is first? Asked Walven.
That's when the arguing began, and it became clear that something needed to be done. Part of the squad wanted the boys to each take a short shift, while the other part wanted half the boys to take longer shifts on alternating nights. The The merits of both were discussed, and neither party wanted to yield to the other.
"We've wasted an hour debating," said Walven sourly. "One thing is clear, we need a leader."
"And that should be you, should it?" asked Verd, suspiciously.
"I offer myself as a candidate," said Yeetin, officiously.
Everyone ignored him, almost.
"He's got as much right as any," pointed out Handel.
"So, who do we want to lead us?" asked Gurrendor,
the first time the mage had spoken since the monk left them to themselves. He picked a few twigs out of the fire and began breaking them up.
"I say we leave it to the gods to decide. Whoever gets the burnt twig leads until this time tomorrow. Then we'll pick again."
No reasonable argument could be made against the plan, so it was adopted, and soon Handel was chosen as the leader of the squad. He set the watch on alternating shifts, giving half of them at least one full night of rest every other day. Rondal was satisfied with the plan and even volunteered to take one of the midnight shifts. Then the horn rang for their assembly. Opening ceremonies, the beginning of their long, dark journey toward the realization of the mystery. No one disturbed them that night, as the other camps were as excited and eager as theirs to train. The next morning, an hour before dawn, they were less eager. The chill had been more than the thin blankets were made for. The ancients and war brothers began rousing the squads while the stars were still in the sky, using drums and trumpets and whatever else they cared to make noise with. Ancient Feslin's grinning face informed them that this was the week of the left foot, in which they were to learn the intricacies of a formal unit formation. He taught them how to stand, how to walk, and how to march within short order, and soon the cold was forgotten as they marched to their place on the practice field. That's where the real fun began. As the sun was just lightening the eastern sky, the sweaty boys were taught the basic exercises of Imperial Infantry calisthenics, an essential part of the mysteries. At first, Rondal found the exercise a pointless waste of time. Then he found them boring. But soon, as his muscles began to ache and the ancients screamed at everyone indiscriminately, the vigorous, repetitive movements became a challenge. Rondal was no weakling, but he quickly learned just how untrained and weak he was. And if he chanced to forget, ancient Feslin made certain to remind him in excruciating and voluminous detail. Every moment Rondal expected them to end the exercise, certain that they'd pushed them all to their limits. But then more exercises came. His chest began heaving with exertion, his rough tunic became soaked with sweat, and his arms and legs began to quiver under the strain. A few boys dropped out early, and were subjected to such brutal humiliations as a result that the rest resolved to move faster. Rondal merely kept his body doing what it was supposed to, as long as he physically could, and then some. Finally, collapsed in a heap, the cadets were allowed to rest for a few moments while a war brother read morning prayers. Then they were forced to get up and run the 3 long miles up to the gates of Raylan Kor, proper, and then back. They arrived just as the light was bright enough for Rondal to see Yeetin's acne. They would have collapsed in a heap had ancient Feslin not told them they had but 20 minutes until the first bell of the day to prepare and eat breakfast. They spent the morning learning how to march. Rondal always thought such a thing was pretty straightforward. After all, it was just walking. But it didn't take long for Rondal to discover the painful difference between walking and marching. All morning long, they marched, from one end of the field to the other and back again. Nothing more complicated, and nothing he had ever done seemed harder after the first 3 hours. When the horn called for lunch, they sprinted back to their camp to gobble down a few morsels, drink some water and tend to their personal needs. All too soon the drums summoning them to parade sounded. Rondal made it back in time, still chewing a brutally hard piece of journey bread, but not everyone was so lucky. Yeetin and Orphil were both late to formation. After he saw what they went through as a result, Rondal vowed never to be late for formation.
"This is your squad banner," the captain of neophytes announced as the ancients handed out long poles with small green flags on the end of them to every 10th man. "Each banner has an animal, your squad number and your company number." Rondal stole a quick glance at theirs, clasped in Verd's meaty fist.
It had a large 2, a smaller 3, and Arachiel embroidered upon it. He'd never seen one of the nocturnal mammals himself, but the goofy nose and the big eyes didn't seem particularly terror-inspiring, despite the beast's reputation.
For a cadet squad to lose its banner is the supreme dishonor. A squad without their banner at morning call is subject to restrictions and punishments. A squad who loses their banner and does not recover it does not pass the mystery. Protect and guard your banner, and remember how great the honor is in capturing the banner of an enemy.
He said nothing further on the subject, but the intent was clear. Rondal immediately began to feel anxiety about the stupid pole.
This morning you learned how to walk in a straight line. That's the essence of the left foot, and you'll master that this week.
There were loud groans. That's how the rest of the week of the left foot went. Just when they thought there could be no more nuance to the art, they learned even more about marching. After a week, they were indeed masters of the art. That's when they learned about the weak of the right foot.
Last week you learned how to walk a straight line, their war brother informed them. This week you will learn to walk in a straight line, carrying a spear.
There were even louder groans.
But since none of you can be trusted with proper weapons yet, we shall use these poles instead,
he said, gesturing to 2 great piles of staves on either side of his horse. Each one was far thicker than any spear shaft. For the next 7 hours, until long past twilight, they learned how to march bearing a spear, and then learned the rudiments of presenting and shouldering the weapons. When Rondal could have sworn he'd marched his feet off, they were summoned into formation for the War Brothers' Vespers and a sermon. At last, when the moon was rising, they were dismissed, their overlarge spears over their shoulders, back to their camps to eat and sleep.
"Sweet Mother Trig, are they trying to kill us?"
complained Yeetin, his voice twisted into a torturous whine.
"This is just week 2. I can't properly feel my legs anymore."
"Oh, shut up,"
growled Verd, as he savagely tore into his ration of journey bread. The soup was not hot yet, but some were gulping it down anyway, clumps and all.
"All you did today was bitch and moan, and I'm sick of it."
"If they would just be reasonable,"
Yeetin insisted, rubbing his aching, bone-thin calves.
"They don't have to be reasonable," Orphil said philosophically. "In fact, being reasonable doesn't make good soldiers. They're just following the same book every other imperially trained infantry has for the last 1,000 years. The original mystery is said to have come from Perwin, a gift of the primal god of war to the ancient warriors of Novaminus. The mystery has been completed by hundreds of thousands of soldiers. It works."
"It didn't work against the Narasi," argued Jofard, his mouth full. "We rolled right over them." "I don't believe you were there,"
the Remiran, whose ancestors had fought against them, shot back, "and the Imperial Army was still better trained than your barbarian cavalry. You just had more and could move them faster. But your ancestors never won an infantry engagement against the Majocracy. On horseback, by surprise and stealth, your ancestors excelled. On foot, they died in droves. Kamaklavan conquered from horseback, but he could not rule until the infantry surrendered."
"Why the hells are you talking?"
moaned Handel, his head between his knees.
"Let's pick a leader, post a guard, and go to sleep. Do you know how soon dawn is?"
"Is that an order, petty captain?"
asked Dolwyn with a hint of sarcasm.
"Damn right it is. Do it now, my last order."
Walvin drew the burnt twig. He set the watch, finished his stew, and rolled into a blanket. Rondal followed suit, the cold hard ground beckoning him like the softest feather bed. He was asleep the moment his head touched the ground. Once again, ancient Feslin awakened them before dawn for calisthenics, and thence to their mastery of the right foot. That day they learned not only how to march with a spear, but how to move a spear while marching. After a long morning marching, another run up to the gate, and a surprise additional ration of bitter bread, they fell in for a surprise inspection. Rondal swung his oversized spear haft as deftly as possible, but nothing seemed to please ancient Feslin. He hurled insults at him, berating him for a coward and the son of a whore. Rondal took it in stride. He'd accused Dalwyn of abusing sheep. When he came to Yeetin, however, the ancient was really harsh. He virtually devoured the lad, who quivered uncontrollably with fear as the iron-jawed ancient bellowed out his deficiencies in colourful terms. It didn't help his cause that Yeetin could barely handle the 3-inch-thick pole in his slender fingers, or lift it with his frail arms, as the ancient proved by knocking it out of his hand repeatedly. Disgusted, ancient Feslin ordered the entire squad punished. Their 3-inch poles were replaced by 5-inch poles, almost unbearably heavy. Then they practiced marching in formation again until the evening stars rose. And so it went, and even the beginning of the left-hand week was starting to be anticipated. Anything had to be better than marching with a stupid pole for hours on end. While everyone was furious at Yeetin, they had not the strength to even bully him much once they slumped back to camp. They half-heartedly drew lots, ate a few mouthfuls, drank, and passed out. Rondal had been assigned the first watch, and he could barely keep his eyes open. The next week, the week of the left hand, went much the same, only to their burden was added a bulky 25-pound wooden shield. The strap was cumbersome and fit unevenly. The weight made their shoulders ache within the first hour. By the end of the week, they were exhausted, ready to collapse into dust every night. That's when they were forced on a scenic march through the bog to the south of the fortress. They went to sleep that week, often unable to even prepare a proper meal. The next week was the week of the right hand. They were finally issued heavy wooden swords, portraying short infantrymen's blades. They did not use them to practice fighting, they simply marched with them. On and on they marched. That first right-hand afternoon they also received backpacks, each containing a few extra rations and a bottle of water. It also contained 3 heavy sticks of firewood. They marched to the gate and back again. Rondal was starting to hate the sight of the bloody gate. The bruises and blisters on his feet were nearly unbearable. He and the other magi used what spells they could to tend the squad's wounds at night, but none were medically gifted. Only with his witchstone could he have summoned the power needed to do a proper job. At most, he stopped the pain enough to allow them to sleep. Most hadn't even stripped off their packs, falling asleep the moment they returned to camp, their poles and shields cast aside. That was the night of the first raid. One of the other squads had exhausted their food supply, and decided the third squad's could make up for it. Luckily, their watchman had better sight than the Rakiel that was their totem. Gurrendor had employed a cat's eye spell during his watch, and was able to rouse his mates quietly just before the first of them entered the camp. What ensued was a confused melee with wooden swords and poles, where Fend could only barely discern friend in the darkness. Rondal roused himself quickly enough. He'd learned that trick back in Bovol, during the siege. He was challenged almost immediately. Wooden sword in hand, he faced his opponent, his mage sight coming to him automatically. Despite days of exhausting toil, little food and little sleep, he didn't feel his muscles ache or his bones protest as he gave a savage cry and defended his territory. He was surprised how quickly he responded, and how viscerally. He wasn't the only one. The Rakiel squad responded with a punishing defense, letting their desperation and frustrations fuel their response. It only took a few hard strokes to speed the other cadets on their way. Rondal fared well in that attack. He'd faced 2 different boys and bested them both in their contests, forcing them to withdraw. Most of his fellows were victorious as well, with only a few nursing bruises. Rondal screamed triumphantly over the victory. Someone stirred the fire to life and they spent a few moments ensuring neither the flag nor the dwindling food supply had been touched. After congratulating each other and doubling the watch, they crawled back into their blankets, sore and tired, but feeling victorious. 2 more days they marched and marched and marched, until the mystery mandated 2 days of rest and instruction. Rondal had stopped being able to feel his feet days before, and his back only ached miserably, not intolerably now. He was shocked, as he sat at morning prayer, that his legs felt like marching now. He marveled at the sadistic whim of the war god in the irony of that. The day of rest included little actual rest. Instead, it involved instruction in rudimentary swordplay and a whole new regimen of calisthenics
designed to strengthen the muscles of the infantry swordsman. They learned the rite of the sword, the ancient basis for all swordplay, according to legend. They practiced with their wooden blades for hours, not sparring, just exercising against each other in predetermined patterns. There were sacred chants associated with each exercise to help time them. It became an elaborate dance, one he strove to master, else he attracted the ire of the ancients and the scorn of his fellows. Like a magical exercise, he abandoned his mind and body to performing the moves as flawlessly as possible. To his horror, Rondol realized what the purpose of the rite was. He was learning swordplay, learning it at a fundamental level, at his bones. He'd always swung his sword inelegantly before, but the rhythms and the pattern of strikes against his partner's blade were teaching his body and his mind to respond as one, like a magic spell. He even caught himself humming the cadence of some of the rites to himself and imagining his positioning as he did so. Rondol wasn't a natural swordsman. The swordmaster assigned to the squad repeated every criticism Sire Kay had ever made of his swordplay, but without the restraint of chivalry or propriety. But for the first time, he recognized swordplay as a subject to be studied, not just a practiced reflex or a desperate means of self-preservation. Instead, he began to see it as expressions of leverage and force, not pointless exercise. It was like lining up all of the proper sigils in the correct positions in a spell, he discovered. You first had to learn the fundamentals. With every dull impact on his wooden blade, his body and his mind began cooperating a little more, instead of working at odds. And much to his surprise, he got better. Not much at first, but he began avoiding mistakes he had been making for months, so that when the first few real sparring matches came along during the Feast of the Crown, he was able to hold his own against his opponents. Most of his squadmates were likewise acquiring proficiency. Yeetin, on the other hand, was hopeless. He couldn't push his lanky frame into the proper position, so his blade was always at the wrong place at the wrong time. His arms and legs and ribs were striped with bruises that night. He persisted in moaning his pain until one of his squadmates offered to knock him unconscious. The second day, to their surprise, they were actually allowed to rest. They slept until the sun was in the sky, their bodies grateful. That morning they were given a bonus ration of sweetened oatmeal with nuts and raisins, and half a mug of watery ale, far worse than what they served in the dining hall at Denarian. It was the most delicious ale Rondol ever tasted. Then the war brothers began their rites. There were sermons on life and death and duty and honor, the four blessings of the war god, no matter his name, the power to defend and to attack, the power to destroy and obey. Unity in purpose led to the greater honor and glory. The solemn lectures went on and on. Only the fact that he wasn't marching kept Rondol from squirming out of boredom half of the time. Rondol paid attention mostly because there was nothing better to do. It was even kind of interesting, the philosophical side of the mysteries. The nature of the soul was discussed. The legality and moral propriety of taking life in battle was discussed. The warrior monks of Duin and the other war gods elicited them each to testify of their own experiences in battle. There were few boys among them who had any experience in combat due to their age or class, and most of what was spoken of were simple skirmishes between feuding families, or, in one case, a raid on a farmstead during a boundary dispute. When the war brother called him out, unexpectedly, as a veteran of battle and invited him to speak, Rondol surprised himself by discussing the worst moments of the Beauval siege in front of everyone. While his squadmates and rivals alike listened, he told them about the sudden attack on his homeland, the slaughter of his neighbors and friends, the unexpected siege, the abject fear he'd felt from a threat that wanted to kill him. He spoke of how he was given a blade and a wand and a witchstone, and not much else, and how he was forced to fight for his life. He spoke of the first time he had faced a screaming, fanatical goblin face to face and had stuck his sword into his throat until it stopped moving. He spoke of the dozens he'd killed since, and the other horrors he'd faced. Trolls, hobgoblins, and even the dragon at Cambrian Castle. That last admission brought a newfound respect from his squadmates. He downplayed his role in the contests as desperate affairs. He'd followed orders. He fought as hard as he could. but he dismissed his deeds as minor compared to the others who'd fought with him in the war. There were other tales, some no doubt embellished, but Rondol's testimony captivated them all. There were plenty of unblooded warriors among them who immediately wanted more details, eager for that kind of glory. Rondol envied their innocence. If he'd had his preference, he would have stayed at Inarian Academy until he'd read every book and mastered every spell his talent could bear, and then retired there. Just before Vespers, they were unexpectedly given a few free hours to themselves. Many of his squad mates used it to sleep. Others foraged through the bogs for berries and roots to add to the last of their diminishing supply of food, although after Vespers, they were each given a honey cake and another half measure of ale. The next morning, they were issued fresh rations, but a third less than the previous week.
"How do they expect us to survive on this?" Yeetin wailed as he looked at the diminished supplies in the hamper. "We'll starve to death."
"That's the point," groaned Walven. "They feed us less, we get hungry."
"I'm already hungry," complained Yeetin.
"So is every other boy out there," Dalwin reminded them.
"That's going to make the competition for resources far more difficult."
"Not if we're dead of starvation,"
Yeetin moaned.
"You barely eat enough to keep a squirrel alive anyway,"
Orphil dismissed. "Some of us have man-sized stomachs to fill." Walven looked uneasy, his eyes already peering at the other camps around the field.
"Everyone is going to be hungry. We'd better do a very good job of hiding this," he warned, "and be particularly careful with the watch."
The boys did what they could with the little food they'd been issued, splitting it into three small caches around the campsite. As careful as they were, however, upon their return from a class on close-quarters infantry swordplay, they discovered that their preparations had not kept them secure. Their camp had been raided while they were away. The Rakiel squad stood around and stared in disbelief at the chaos. Their camp had been torn apart, their blankets torn, scattered and muddied. The little food that had been out was gone, and one of the two other caches had been raided. What was left could take them 2 days, perhaps three, but no more.
"I want their heads," Rax, the leader for the day, howled, his eyes blazing. "I don't know who they are, but—"
"Stop," ordered Walven, as the boys began to converge on the camp.
"Nobody move. If we're going to find out who did this, we need to read the signs."
Gorondor nodded and started waving his hands around to summon Magesight.
"I'm reviewing the area," he reported. "No one get in the way."
Rondol wondered why he bothered with all of that hand-waving stuff. It was an easy enough spell to do without it. He summoned Magesight himself and began scanning, and assumed Yeetin had as well.
"We know who did it,"
Dalwin said bitterly.
"Actually, we don't," Orphil pointed out. "It could be anyone. Trying to throw blame and suspicion on anyone else would be basic strategy."
"But those assholes in—"
"Exactly," Walven agreed. "Those are just the assholes we'd suspect. This makes it possible, if not probable, that we were targeted because they'd be suspected."
"And whoever did this is trying to get us to go after them," Rondol agreed. "That's as good a theory as any."
"Let's see if the evidence fits it," Yeetin said airily. "I see 5 sets of footprints,"
he reported. "Agreed," Gurrendor nodded. 2 smaller boys, 3 bigger, almost adults. Same crappy boots as we all wear.
But," Rondol observed, "one of them carried a staff or spear and just stood there. His prints are still there, deep in the mud. All he did was break our water jar," he finished sourly.
"Phalor's flaming asshole," Orphil swore colourfully. "I can see stealing the food, but breaking our water jar? What pricks!"
"That's what makes me think that it was a raid designed to lure us into attacking the wrong troop," agreed Gurrendor sagely. "If they just wanted food, that would be reasonable enough. We had our banner with us, so the only reason to do that was to piss us off," he reasoned.
"Done," Rax said, swinging his wooden sword angrily at the air. "Just tell me which assholes to kill."
"We're working on it," Yeetin whined, irritated. "Guards! All right, look for distinctions in their prints," he suggested.
Not only were the Magi looking, but Jofard, who fancied himself a hunter,
was examining the prints in the mud. "I've got something," he said quietly, as he knelt near the edge of the ruined camp. "Look at this." Rondal came over to examine the spot himself. "See this knee print in the mud? It's as wide as my cock. Whoever knelt here was a chubby little bugger. And deep. Look for a fat, muddy knee, and you're in the right domain." "Can you, Mad Jay, do anything with spit?" Rax asked. "I think someone spat over here. At least it looks fresh." "Let me take a look," Yeetin said, curious.
"That's disgusting," Handel said, making a face.
"We didn't do any spit spells at Allah," conceded Gurrendor. "Let the man work," Walvin ordered.
"Every drop of sweat contains a man's essence," Yeetin said matter-of-factly, as he knelt next to the glob of sputum on a leaf of an evergreen shrub. "Every drop of blood, piss, shit, and spit," he said almost reverently. "If you know how to draw forth that essence."
He closed his eyes and began a spell. "No one disturb him," Rondal ordered. He hated when someone did that to him while he was trying to cast a spell, especially now that he had to raise power the old-fashioned way. "But assuming he's successful, what are we going to do about it?" he asked quietly.
"What do you mean?" Rax asked, confused. "I want their heads."
"That seems like a lot for a little raid," Orphil pointed out. "I'm pissed too, but what can we really do?"
"Steal it back," answered Handel.
"Maybe," Walvin conceded, "or maybe we get our asses kicked, because that's what they're expecting."
"But that's what I'm expecting too," Rax said angrily.
"But that's not winning," Walvin pointed out. "That's revenge, not victory. We need to eat. That's our first priority. It would be lovely to punish who did this so that no one else will be tempted, but if we spend all of our energy on that, we'll starve in the meantime. Getting ourselves messed up and injured on our own time won't help us be victorious."
"Then what will?" demanded Orphil.
"Eating," Handel supplied. "Eating a lot would be, in my mind, a point of victory."
"Exactly," agreed Walvin. "We need to eat. We also need a new water jar. We can waste a lot of time running around figuring out who did this, coming up with some brilliant scheme to get back at them and get ourselves beat up too, or we can focus on the problem instead."
"So how do we eat?" asked Orphil. "Rob someone else."
"That would be one way," conceded Handel, "but let's face it, no one else got more food than we did."
"So we go outside of our supplies and forage," reasoned Walvin. "Ancient Feslin always said that was allowed. These are swamps. Even this early in the spring there are fish and frogs and other things," he said, looking a little grim. "We can hunt."
"I can hunt with proper equipment," Jofard offered.
"You can hunt without the proper equipment," ordered Walvin. "See what you can put together. In fact, everyone should start hunting. Any kind of protein would work. Does anyone know what kind of tubers and such are edible from a swamp?"
"Don't pick any fungus," suggested Yeetin. "There are thousands of deadly poisonous ones, especially in swamps."
"There are birds, too," agreed Orphil, suddenly looking up.
"Maybe use a spear?"
"Or sling," suggested Handel. "I used to be good with a sling."
"Get good again," Walvin said. "Quick. The faster we pile up protein, the better off we'll be. That goes for everyone." He looked thoughtful for a moment.
"All right. Who has cooking duty?"
"Cook the rest of the food. All of it. Tonight."
"Why?" asked Yeetin. "Are you that confident that we'll be successful hunting?"
"I'm that confident that knowing there isn't any food left back at camp will motivate you better," Walvin replied. "Besides, what's in your belly can't be stolen." Even though he was not the official leader, Walvin's calmly delivered and well-reasoned plan was what they needed. The effort to identify the raiders was abandoned for scavenging duties. Most of the boys headed into the swamp to forage, while the others prepared the two soup cakes and the pound of grits left in their larder. Rondal followed after the foragers, unsure about what he could do. But he knew from personal experience just how powerful a motivation hunger could be. He had little native energy for magic, outside of a few cantrips,
but mage sight revealed the number of creatures in the marshes. He discovered a nest of some kind of mammal he'd never seen before, one that bore a striking resemblance to a giant rat, and called it to the other boys' attention. As they trooped off to hunt down their prey, he turned his focus toward the water. Water was the abode of all life, his masters had told him frequently enough. These swamps were beginning to teem with it, now that winter's harsh edge was past. Though he felt handicapped without the resources of his stone, Rondel was not useless. With a little searching, he found two big tubers he knew were edible and dug them out of the mud with his bare hands, enough to feed the squad for a day. The rest of the hunters had varying degrees of success. When the last of them dragged back to camp at twilight, there were three small mammals, six tubers, four decent-sized fish, and two birds. Gurundor had fashioned a bolo from a few thongs and had plucked them both off the same branch. There were also some winterberries, herbs, marshnuts, and other fare they had managed to gather in the dying light. It wasn't quite a feast, but there was a feeling of triumph as they sat around their fire that night. Even Yeetin, who had found some wild garlic and some rosemary, was in a good mood. They roasted the meat over the fire before adding it to the soup, and then devoured the whole kettle. Before bed, Walven detailed two boys to fetch water in the empty kettle. The pared-down tubers were boiled until the fire died. "Wasn't this a better outcome than plotting revenge?" Walven asked, just after they chose lots for leadership. Orphil was chosen this time, which made the boy nervous. "I still want their heads," muttered Rax.
"They wouldn't taste as good as this, whatever it is,"
Handel assured him, gesturing with a roasted limb of some creature.
"If we'd gone after our raiders, we would have gone to bed with bruises and empty bellies. I prefer this outcome."
"That doesn't mean we can't keep our eyes open," Jofard nodded. "If we can figure out who did this, we wait for a shot, and then we take it. Hard."
"Agreed,"
Walven nodded. "But let's wait for the gods to give us the opportunity." The next morning, the beginning of the Week of the Head, they began learning small unit tactics on the practice field, participating in squad-by-squad sorties to demonstrate each valuable point. The ancient, proven imperial system of infantry triads, in which two shield men, side by side, protected a pole arm or spearman, was hammered into their brains until they all began to reform that way every time their line was crushed. The ancients yelled at them with renewed purpose as they forced the boys to learn to work together in a coordinated manner. Ancient Feslin heatedly defamed their ancestry, their personal habits, and their likely sexual proclivities as they struggled. Like the rest of the mysteries, it was a brutal exercise. For 3 days they skirmished and learned and drilled and practiced. Rondal found the weight of his shield less bothersome and was more focused on his stance and his guard than his misery. It helped that every infraction against their orderly deployment was punished harshly. He quickly learned not to mess up more than once, else his whole squad suffered. Yeetin was responsible for several painful exercises, but even he learned. They learned so thoroughly that they had dreams of formations and maneuvers that night, after chalking down their scavenged dinner. Along with the physical practice, they were lectured on the theory of unit tactics, and schooled in the horn calls and drumbeats that were code for the professional infantry battalion. The pace was merciless, but when problems arose with a squad, there seemed to be no shortage of war brothers and ancients willing to take a squad in hand and work with them remedially. The fourth day, after reprising all that they had learned, they were given an opportunity to demonstrate it. Three caches of food were placed atop three wooden pillars, along with a cask of ale, bread, and other luxuries. The short rations had been telling on everyone. It wasn't unusual to hear bellies grumbling in combat. So when the bounty was displayed before the squadrons, there was a tremendous interest. "The rules are simple," Ancient Feslin said with a wolfish grin. "The squad who can capture and hang on to the food gets it." The horn call to prepare for action sounded. "I want that food," Rax declared.
"We all do," muttered Walven. "What are your orders, squad leader?"
Jofard had drawn the previous night. He quickly looked around. "Orphil, Handel, see if the squads to each side of us are interested in teaming up and splitting the loot," he said quickly. "When the horn call sounds, whoever gets there first is going to have a very brief advantage. Then they're going to be defending against everyone else who gets there.
Some will wait for the victors to emerge and pounce.
So how do we get around that? Asked Rax, exasperated.
The Magi,
Jofar decided. Can you not do something to discourage anyone from getting too close? The three Magi conferred quickly. They had few spells hung between the three of them, but they managed to figure out some ways to keep other squads at bay. They discussed it with Jofard, who agreed with them. Their fellows in the second and fourth squads of Third Company were willing to go along with them. Jofard suggested they protect the flanks of the pole, while the third squad took care of the retrieval and removal. A hasty 2-minute conversation between the three squad leaders ensued, and with surprisingly little debate, second squad insisted on first crack at the ale, should they prevail. They hammered out a quick battle plan. Just as they finished, the horn called to action sounded.
Let's go!
Bellowed Jofard, pushing Yeetin, the designated banner-bearer that day, forward. The rest of the squad formed up with shields at the ready behind him and charged across the field, the other two squads flanking them. It only took seconds for their plan to fall apart. The fourth squad became entangled with elements of the first squad of Fourth Company, and half of them got left behind to hold the others at bay. The second squad arrived at the base of the pillar first, thanks to some good sprinters in their ranks, but was immediately set upon by others. The bottom of the pillar churned into a general brawl as the desperate boys smote each other with their wooden swords. They had all been cautioned against excessive force in such trials, but the desperation and competitive spirit in them had been aroused. Jofard stared at the mess in dismay, the pile of supplies sitting alluringly out of reach of the fray below.
This is stupid, he said, shaking his head. We'll never get to the base of the pillar.
Then let's come at it from another way, Rondal suggested, his brain churning with options. He thought of a plan.
Jofard looked at him thoughtfully. What do you have in mind?
Rondal explained to the young squire, who started to grin.
That is a completely and utterly dangerous feat that has such a small chance of working that it wouldn't be fair not to try it, he decided. Let's get organized. It didn't take as long as Rondal feared. Soon his squad, along with the remnants of the fourth squad, who had been able to break away, formed up in a wedge and charged into the fray, getting as close to the base of the pillar as possible. The sudden force of their attack pushed the mob to the side, but it quickly reformed and started hammering against them. They didn't have to remain there long, however. The boys in the middle of the wedge raised their shields overhead, creating a rough ramp for Verd, the lightest of them, to climb. He was still more than 5 feet away from the platform, but a risky leap brought him scrambling to the top. Grinning, once he found his footing, he began chucking the food to his mates. That only increased the intensity of the fighting below. To distract some of them, he took a bag of beans and flung it as far from the pillar as he could. Nearly a third of the hungry crowd went after it, allowing the rest of the squad to hold their formation long enough for the majority of the food to be retrieved. But getting it and keeping it were two different things. Once they were burdened by the supplies, it became much harder to fight. Jofard ended up detailing Orphil and Verd to hold the food between their shields. Carried like a stretcher, the rest of the squad huddled protectively around it. Skirmishers from the other squads who managed to disengage flanked them, but there were no end to those who would challenge their victory.
Now would be a good time, Jofard cried, as he laid into a brace of would-be raiders with his wooden sword.
The beefy boy pushed them back, but there were more lined up behind. Rondal nodded and began to access his spell. It was a much, much abbreviated version of a war magic spell, Paramundra's Horn, and only produced an ear-splitting shriek, but it rang in the helms of the unprepared painfully, while the boys of the third squad had been able to steel themselves for the aural assault. While the irritating spell didn't quite clear a path in front of them, it did reduce the number of stragglers willing to confront the well-organized effort.
That, Jofard said as the spell faded and the losers began to fall in behind them, was a satisfying display of warfare, gentlemen.
Ha! snorted Walvin. It was a mob, nothing more. Good work getting us organized, he conceded.
Good work to the Magi who cleared the field, called Orphil, who was struggling with the load. If we had to face one more angry band, I would have dropped this.
Who has the ale? Asked Rax, sounding desperate. That night it was a true celebration.
The boys of the third squad had no issue with splitting the bounty fairly, as they had promised. There were general congratulations offered to all that night, as the small barrel of ale was drained, and in the morning the squad had a worthy replacement for their broken water jar. They finished out their week on small unit tactics with some advanced work, specifically how to prepare for a cavalry charge, and then they had two more days of instruction. This time the Ward brothers preached to them about rank and obedience, duty and honour. The divine rules of warfare were read and discussed, giving every man a clearer sense of his duty on and off the field, in and out of camp. The laws of war were many and varied, covering how to deal with civilians, a soldier's duty to his lord and commander, the right to demand fair payment for services and risk, and what targets were restricted from attack, or, conversely, what targets were expected to be attacked. The boys enjoyed their lighter duty after weeks of warfare drills. The food improved somewhat too. Twice they were given honey biscuits and weak ale, in addition to boiled eggs and beans. Rondal expected another week of combat tactics after the rest days, as the week of the heart was next, but instead the next morning they were issued fresh packs, complete with new blankets, socks, bandages and other gear, in addition to their armour, shields, helms and weapons. And then they marched, not merely back and forth across the practice yard, as they had been doing. After a brief luncheon, they reformed into one giant line and marched completely out of the Raylancourt complex and into the southern Castali countryside. All afternoon, they tromped down the dusty dirt road north of the fortress. Along the way, they learned a number of marching songs to keep their cadence, some of ancient source and some more recent, but all obscene and entertaining. The plod of boot after boot, one foot in front of the other for mile after mile, soon turned every boy's feet into numb stumps inside their boots. The ancients and war brothers escorting them on horseback seemed to delight in finding fault with their marching. Only once before dark did they allow the boys to rest, before they returned them to the road. When twilight fell, Rondal was sure that they would stop. But they didn't. On and on they marched, as twilight gave way to darkness, until the muttered complaints from all began to swarm. Ancient Feslin heard them and just smiled. They kept marching. Eventually, when it was clear that no amount of complaining would stop the march, things quieted down. Only then did the ancients halt the column and allow the boys to fall out of formation. Most fell asleep beside the road, still in armour, wrapped in their mantles with their heads on their packs. Rondal was tempted, but he had been chosen as squad commander that day, the first time he'd gotten the honour. So it was to him that his squad complained bitterly, those who still had breath to do so. He took their concerns to ancient Feslin, who did not even try to look sympathetic. But he did issue rations, a stack of 10 flats of journey bread and a sack of tough, dried sausages. Rondal happily distributed the food and oversaw the election of Dolwyn as the next day's leader as they ate the rations cold. Then Rondal passed out. The next day the march continued, in the wrong direction. "Aren't we headed back to camp?" Dolwyn asked ancient Feslin. "Sir?" "Today you're to discover the wonder that is the forced march," the old veteran explained. "We stop at dusk, no sooner." As appalling as it sounded, the marching was worse. It became a monotonous trial of pain and endurance. Every boy pushed themselves and each other when they failed to find their own stock of initiative. Talking was discouraged, beyond singing cadences, and that left them all alone with their thoughts and their tired feet. "How long do you think we've covered?" asked Rax, anxiously, around noon. 30 miles? Suggested Handel. "More like 20 since yesterday," Orphil disagreed. "Quiet!" called a passing war brother. "Quiet in the ranks!" Rondal used the time at first to go over spells in his head, but even that grew boring after a while. He recited the sacred periodic table and the laws of magic, and even Sire Rose's silly 16 laws of love, but his brain inevitably brought his mind back to the darkness he was circling. While he tried to avoid it as long as he could, the plodding pace, mental exercise, and enforced activity soon compelled him to think about that awful night once again, the betrayal of Caffin of Gyre and the death of Estasia. He hadn't thought about the poor girl in weeks, he realized guiltily.
But then he recalled that was what he wanted to find here in Raylan Kaur. After weeks of avoiding the matter, suddenly his mind became obsessed with it. Over and over, the tragic night played out in his mind, and he found himself growing angry, then resentful, then racked with despair. And still his feet marched on. At one point, he found himself crying, tears rolling down his face as his exhausted body trudged on. At first, he thought they were merely tears of misery, but soon his frustrated mind began throwing every awful memory and horrible mistake he'd ever made against itself. Inside his head, he savagely recriminated himself over his many, many errors and losses, and tallied the lives lost because of him, from his mother to Astasia. He even thought about poor Urik, the younger apprentice to Garkescu, back in Boval before the invasion, whose abuse by the oldest apprentice had driven him mad. Rondal had silently allowed him to be abused, rather than disrupt the way things were established in the tent's professional household. Both his fellow apprentices had died as an indirect result. That did his peace of mind no favours. He saw himself as a miserable excuse for a human being, and he didn't see why anyone, Master Min, Lady Alia, Sire Kay, anyone, would want to associate with him. His head hung low as he marched, his spear on one shoulder, his shield on the other, his pack trying to drag him to the ground. But his feet marched on. Tears rolled down his face in his anguish, and yet still his feet kept marching. The pain in his arms and shoulders and tortured legs screamed as agonizing as any he'd ever felt, but he kept on marching. Perhaps, he reasoned, if he wore his feet off and died of exhaustion, then the unremitting emotional pain would come to an end. A war brother, swathed in a bull-skin mantle and an elaborate headdress, rode apace on a rouncy with his section of the column a while and noted Rondal's misery. "Leave it on the road, son," he called after him kindly. "Whatever it is, it's behind you now. March away from it and leave it on the road." He urged his horse forward to dress the line before Rondal could respond. So he just marched, and he tried to leave it on the road. His anger at the dead god and the loss of his beloved mountain home, on the road. His grief over the Bovali dead in the aftermath of the invasion, on the road. The fear he'd disappoint his kind new master, who had given him so much and had asked so little in return, on the road. His terror of death in battle, on the road. The self-loathing he felt for his role in Astasia's death, on the road. The resentment he felt for Tyndall and for his role in her death, on the road. One by one he recalled his follies and foolishness, and he vowed to leave them behind, taking only the lessons learned. That, his mind told his exhausted body, was the only productive thing to do. Cull the wisdom from the chaff of pain and move on another step. And the insights began to occur. Vengeance and retribution, he realized, were tiring and tireless pursuits. They rarely served a higher purpose, or lent themselves to anything constructive, he reasoned. Fear was a childish conceit he could no longer afford, he finally understood. Fear of failure, even, he had to leave behind. It did not matter if he failed, he realized. It only mattered that he tried his hardest. It was acceptable for a knight to die valiantly in pursuit of his quest. It was not acceptable for him to die before he even tried to complete it. The worst of his struggles was with his own self-doubt and self-confidence, he realized, the one sniping eternally at the other. As the column began ascending a steep, graded hill, Rondal reviewed his short life and dwelt on the times when his lack of confidence had undercut him. While it hurt to consider, he recalled that magical evening when he and Astasia and Tyndall, his mind reminded him, had woven that complicated, sophisticated spell together, and he wondered what would have happened had he been bold enough to chance to steal a kiss from the beautiful girl. But fear had stayed him. Fear of rejection, fear of competition, fear of being found unworthy in Astasia's eyes. It all came back to fear. Fear, he realized, had been the core of his failure in almost every case. He remembered the reams of advice he'd been given about the subject of his confidence, everything from swordplay to spellcraft, and he tried to take it all to heart. They all seemed to come back to giving up his fear. Once you gave up fear, he realized, the rest really wasn't that hard. Rondal realized that he had just discovered a powerful insight into Tyndall's character. The boy just wasn't really afraid of much. That might be a factor of his stupidity, but it also accounted for his boldness and his success. Of all his demons, Rondal had the hardest time leaving his feelings for Tyndall on the road. His maddening fellow apprentice had inadvertently humiliated Rondal too many times for him to lightly forgive. It would have been a different thing entirely had he done it on purpose, but mostly Tyndall blundered into his insults and humiliations accidentally. He wasn't trying to be a bully. That was just how he was. It was hard to be angry at that. But it also made it harder to forgive and forget. As his chest heaved like a bellows, and his knees threatened to give out with every step, he followed the boy in front of him, whose helm and hair he had memorized down to the finest fiber and scratch, up that laborious hill. Every step felt as if he was stepping angrily on Tyndall's face. Every bit of pain was worth the feeling of satisfaction he got from it. By the time his part of the column crested the summit, Rondal's steps had lightened. He no longer cared if he was grinding his senior apprentice's face with his boot. Indeed, it seemed like a silly pursuit. He took a deep breath and felt the weight of his pack ease, and even his shield felt lighter. His achingly numb legs continued to carry him onward, but the burden he'd been bearing until then seemed gone, or at least forgotten. When he stumbled to a halt late that evening, after nearly 14 hours of marching, he wasn't as tired as he'd thought he'd be. In fact, he lingered before sleep, volunteering for the first watch. As he sat around the fire between patrols, the bull-hided war brother who'd encouraged him on the march wandered by, apparently in search of him.
"I was hoping I'd run into you, soldier," he said gently. "At ease. I wanted to see how you fared after today."
"It was... I'm all right, war brother," he decided. "I just had a lot of thoughts to work out."
"Marching away your cares is a fine old army tradition," the monk said approvingly. "We've been watching you. You've shown a lot of poise in the field, and a lot of fortitude. A lot more than we'd expected."
"A lot more than I expected, too, if you want the truth,"
Rondal admitted.
"I don't feel like I'm the same person who started this march."
"Ah, then it's working," the war brother said, smiling indulgently. "That's the point of the mystery, son. It must be experienced. It cannot be taught. And it changes you, irrevocably."
"My legs, if nothing else," he quipped, rubbing his sore thighs.
"Far more than your legs," the monk said, pulling a flask from his mantle and offering it to Rondal. "When you lose your identity in the uniformity of the unit," he explained, "you gain the opportunity to remake yourself. Your legs, of course, and the rest of your body are being remade. Your instincts and reflexes are remade, and your understanding of honor and obedience are being remade. But most of all," he said solemnly, as Rondal sipped the fiery liquor, "you remake your soul. When you learn the rights of the soldier and feel them in your bones with every step you take, you open yourself to new reserves of power, fortitude, endurance. You find you can achieve things you never thought possible as a civilian, even as a warrior monk," he smiled.
"Or a night mage," Rondal chuckled.
"I've learned how to study, war brother. I've learned how to learn. I've even learned how to fight. But soldiering, that's an art to itself." "Any idiot can pick up a sword and learn to swing it hard enough to kill," the monk agreed. "Any tribe can train its men to be warriors, fierce warriors. But the difference between a warrior and a soldier is the difference between honor and duty. And with duty comes obedience. Learning to subject yourself to the orders of those above and contribute to the battle to the best of your ability. That is the art of the soldier."
"I never wanted to be a soldier," Rondal warned the monk. "I only vaguely wanted to be a mage."
"What did you want to be?" the old monk asked.
Rondal considered the unexpected question. No one had ever really asked him before.
"Wise,"
he finally said. "I guess I wanted to be the one who knew everything all the time."
"Well, now you've learned the mysteries of Duin, the art of the soldier," reasoned the monk, taking a sip from the flask. "And in learning that art, you've already harvested one of the main benefits the mystery has to offer the initiate."
"What's that?" Rondal asked, curious.
"Pride," the monk grunted. "You have learned pride in yourself.
You came here a boy, and while that boy was unmade in the struggle to survive, you found the pride in yourself you needed to succeed, to thrive, even. As I said, we've been watching you. You've done better than expected, and that shall please your master immensely.
That pleased Rondal immensely. After the monk left, he basked in the afterglow of the praise, reflecting on his time at Raylan Kaur. He really had cultivated some pride in himself, he realized. He had learned the craft of sword and shield, of command and order, of attack and defense, just as thousands upon thousands before him had. When he had completed the mysteries, he would be as fit as any soldier in the duchies. Regardless of what else he was, mage, knight, lord, scholar, he would always have this, the skills and knowledge of a soldier, the training and understanding of soldiery, the pride of that accomplishment. No one gave that to him. He had earned it with his sweat and blood and pain. It hadn't been his magical talent, his sophisticated brain, or his title that had gotten him through the mysteries. It had been he, and he alone. He slept fitfully that night, and the next morning awoke emotionally and physically refreshed, almost eager to begin the day. He was in the minority. Most of his squad mates were exhausted.